From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
I have learned that our identities do not have to be defined by putting someone else down, but can be enhanced by lifting somebody else up.
That was U.S. President Barack Obama speaking at the United Nations General Assembly debate on Tuesday.
That they don't have to be defined in opposition to others, but rather by a belief in liberty and equality and justice and fairness.
President Obama is one of more than 150 heads of state gathered in New York City for the General Assembly in the midst of multiple global crises. Press TV's Kovi Tavwe has more.
U.S. President Barack Obama in his last speech as a U.S. president at the UNGA, this being the 71st UNGA, of which he talked at length. He spoke about Russia on a number of occasions. Probably the most references that he made was to Russia, one being that Russia's trying to recover power through force. And what was interesting about one of the references he made to Russia was that if Russia continues to interfere in the affairs of other countries and neighbors, in particular, obviously, Ukraine, that will make its borders less secure. Another interesting statement he made there was that nations need to end proxy wars that fuel disorder, and praised in the beginning of his speech and towards the end where America has been a rare superpower who has thought beyond narrow self-interest.
For more on all of that, we spoke with Professor Tony Montero from Philadelphia Wednesday morning. Professor Montero, wow, it's just everything's popping so fast, it's hard to know what to keep track of.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is what a general crisis looks like.
Yeah, right.
It's not just a crisis that is going to last a couple of years or a couple of months or whatever, man. This is the real thing. And all of the dangers that are inherent in a crisis of this magnitude are present at this time.
Yeah, we got shooting in Syria like crazy. I just saw a report that came through FARS, apparently sourced from Sputnik, that there was a Russian attack on a base of militants in Syria, in some mountains, some secret base. And the report is that there were Americans and Israelis among the people that were killed. We had the attack by the U.S. this past Saturday on the Syrian Arab Army in Syria without permission and violation of international law, the whole scene at the United Nations. And then we had Obama yesterday at the U.N. General Assembly lecturing.
Right, right. And, you know, in a lot of ways, it the central theme, I think, is the Samantha Powers, the U.N. ambassador of the United States, the Samantha Powers doctrine,
right,
of the right to intervene. And if you remember, near the end of his speech, he went on a kind of a rant about the United States as a force for good. And as such, you know, we have the moral high ground, which transcends international law and sovereignty. So it is the Samantha Powers doctrine of the right to intervene, of humanitarian intervention. And also the other side of it is, in keeping with the new Cold War, the rhetoric of confrontation with Russia. And then we wake up today to learn that the United States flew two supersonic bombers over South Korea,
right,
as a so-called message to the North Koreans about what we would do if they continued to carry out nuclear tests. Now, let me remind you that the Korean Peninsula is in many ways a peninsula of North China, Northeast China.
Right.
So to ratchet up military operations on the Korean Peninsula is tantamount to not sending a message only to North Korea, but to China. And when you add to that the continuing military and naval operations in the South China Sea, you know, we're looking at multiple fronts of potential war. So, you know, there is a great deal of inflammable political material throughout the globe. And it is a very dangerous time. And, of course, it takes place in the midst of this very crazy election cycle for president.
Yeah. You know, just yesterday, we're talking Tuesday, the 20th, when the two B-1 bombers were sent, you know, flying towards North Korea over South Korea. And you're right. I mean, the issue of putting in a THAAD missile system, for example, supposedly to defend South Korea and Japan from North Korea, China sees as a direct threat. This happens the same day that Russia and China finished their first joint military maneuvers in the South China Sea. And so there's clearly a message being sent there as well. There's also trouble that's been stirred up again by Kiev with over the weekend you had an actual attack of, they called them fireworks, but essentially when it comes from Gaza, they call them rocket attacks at the Russian embassy in Kiev for like a 10-15 minute barrage of explosives on the outside of the embassy. So, you know, across the front from the Baltics to the Korean Peninsula, there's an military intimidation going on by the U.S. and confrontation in several theaters, including Syria.
That's right. That's right. And, so it's a very dangerous period that we live in, but these global political events are a manifestation of the crisis of U.S. hegemony. And as I listened to Obama's speech yesterday, even though he attempted to appear confident, I think behind it all was a sense of potential collapse of the American hegemonic, global hegemonic system. If you remember in the speech, he also mentioned the Trans-Pacific Partnership as good for Asia and as a part of the pivot to Asia. But he mentioned the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which commentators from around the world are beginning to see as dead in the water or dead on arrival. It doesn't seem to have the support among the American people, especially given, you know, the Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump's attack upon it and the American public's weariness with these trade deals and what they have meant for the economic conditions of American working people and the poor. And of course, you know, reading in the Financial Times, I forget which commentator it was this week who literally said that the pivot to Asia and the Trans-Pacific Partnership in particular is imploding, is collapsing in upon itself. And this is very interesting, I think.
You know, in terms of measuring the crisis and the steps towards collapse, there was a statement made by, or a rhetorical question raised by Vitaly Churkin, the Russian permanent representative to the UN on Saturday, looking at U.S. policy in Syria specifically, but just in general, he said, "We don't know who's in charge in Washington. Is it the White House or the Pentagon?" Which to me is a very troubling condition to have Russia wondering about that and musing publicly about it in the international sphere. You know, if you consider the possibility that this is, you know, an honest evaluation by Russia's intelligence of what's happening in the United States, and I believe it's hard to not come to that conclusion that there's something very, you know, some serious contradictions going on between not just the White House and the military, the statements that were made last week, but from the White House and from the Pentagon over the Syrian ceasefire, for example, at loggerheads, but also with the CIA and the military's proxies in Syria shooting at each other, and, you know, there's all kinds of contradictions. While they are pushing the borders of Russia and China with all this military hardware, it's scary.
And nuclear weapons, by the way.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, yes, of course. It is very scary. No one knows who's in charge. That is why the military establishment has gotten almost to a person behind Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
Because if she's in the White House, the generals will rule foreign policy in the same way that her State Department became not the center of diplomacy, but the center of war planning. So, yes, this is the great danger. War and peace is at stake. And again, as we have discussed, Don, week after week after week, what is called the left has not understood fully the nature of the crisis of global peace and war that humanity faces. And you cannot say that there is an equivalence between Clinton and Trump on the question of war and peace. So I think a lot of us are going to have to go back to the drawing boards. I mean, we need a principled position. I saw where Ralph Nader made some disparaging statements about Trump. I don't know whether they're disparaging. I mean, they were probably accurate in characterizing his bluster and his persona. But at the end of the day, you know, we look as scientific analysts. We look below the surface and try to understand the logic and the essence of what is going on. And I think what as you and I have said over the weeks, what the ruling elite fears is his position against these grand trade deals and his position as regards pulling back from NATO and pulling back from the nuclear umbrella in Northeast Asia.
You know, You say that the generals are lining up with Clinton, and that's true to a degree, the prominent ones, but it's an interesting divide, because there are a group of generals that have come up behind Trump that are actually the operational ones. You have essentially the political generals on the one hand who, you know, you have to conclude are really there as agents of U.S. Capitol. And the others who were there that are, you know, these are generals. These are guys that were, people that were trained as military experts and commanders. And they're more operational in character. And that means, hopefully, more allegiance to the tradition of civilian control of the military.
There's
just one more thing, because this is all heating up, coincidentally or not, I don't know, at the end of a week where Clinton, far from being a shoo-in, meaning that the elite could, whatever war plans they have, follow the trajectory into the beginning of next year, instead are looking at a strong possibility that it'll be Trump that wins, and maybe stepping up their activities or their timeline in order to have it accomplished during the Obama administration, with or without his cooperation.
Oh, yeah. And you know, the flashpoint in some ways is Syria. Don't forget, a couple of years ago, the red line in the sand. And it was at the beginning of John Kerry's period as Secretary of State, where the U.S. and the Obama administration were pulled back from that line in the sand, red line in the sand scenario, where that was setting up for war in Syria. Now, my point about that is perhaps the operational people on the ground were saying that the military is not in a position to wage another Iraq-type war in Syria. That might be even a tougher war than Iraq was, given that the Syrian Arab army is better equipped, better organized. So maybe it was they, along with other developments, which forced a pullback from operational activity in Syria, which then leaves it to the CIA and special ops to carry out their dirty war in that country.
And there was, of course, pushback from the British Parliament at that time as well, which showed some, a different track might follow politically than the one that followed from the Iraq War invasion.
Absolutely. So, you know, many, many contradictions. You know, if I might just, you know, add another aspect to what we're talking about, you know, one detects a great deal of anxiety and fear generally in the country, but certainly in the left. And as we get closer to November 8th, it's like a domino effect where the left, many of whom had denounced lesser of evilisms, are now trumpeting it and promoting it as the only reasonable strategy, which means voting for Clinton.
Right.
And I just think that is so ill-informed and out of touch with the realities globally. And you know, it's so interesting. You know, you take Obama's visit to the G20 and gets off in China, and they openly humiliate him. And the Philippine government has put the U.S. Special Forces out of their country. Yeah. And the president of the Philippines publicly insults Obama. This, you know, this is high drama. And the Philippines moving away from the American pivot to Asia to now look like their alliance with China against the American. Perhaps they know precisely what we are talking about.
Yeah.
United States is ramping up war with China in the South China Sea.
You know, you're looking at a phenomenon in Asia that we've seen develop in various parts of Europe and developing further, which is a growing acknowledgement, particularly on the part of the Philippines after that Hague decision regarding the South China Sea, the Spratlys, that, hey, guess what? These guys are pushing for war with China, but we're on the front lines. We're going to get blown up.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. And I think at some point the peace movement in South Korea and in Japan are going to make its themselves felt.
Yeah, ready. That's happening. Yeah.
In this whole thing, man. And that's what's missing from the analysis here in this country. The issue of war and peace, of great power confrontation, and what that would look like in the 21st century. You know, so, you know, we're back to basics. We're back to what we've been talking about this whole time. I think we're on the right side of history, Don. I think our understanding of this is more accurate than not. And, you know, like you mentioned to me last week, Peter Laval of Russian television, who had no reason to come out and endorse Trump, did it last week.
On the question of war and peace.
On the question of war and peace. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. And he's an American that lives in Moscow. He's now, you know, lives in Russia, and he's a political commentator in Moscow. But he's an American. Yeah. He grew up in California, and Colorado, yeah. California.
Oh, okay. All right. Yes. Yes. And I'm of the opinion that, you know, of course, the governments in Russia and China do not have a way of accurately assessing Donald Trump. They do recognize the huge danger that Hillary Clinton represents, the huge danger. And so I think, and we're still waiting for Julian Assange's October or maybe now September surprise, what he has to reveal.
And we still have the economy, you know, potential collapse in the economy looming as well. You know, on the whole question of crisis, over the last week, fewer days than that, but over the last week, we've seen a large reversal in the fortunes of the two major party presidential candidates. Also, Jill Stein, like, lighting fire among the millennials in particular. I saw some incredible polling numbers for her that aren't really getting publicized. But with the reversal of the fortunes of Clinton and Trump, and what that might portend for the elites that are lined up behind Clinton, you had this incident in Syria with the U.S. attacking the Syrian army, the whole way that played out at the U.N., the fact that this came as the world leaders were gathering in New York for the U.N. General Assembly, and then this so-called pair of terrorist attacks, you know, where some guy in his late 20s blows up a couple of pressure cookers and suddenly, you know, we're under a state of siege. All of these things are happening at once.
Yeah, and let us not forget the ongoing and continuing murder of black men by the police.
Which seems to be stepping up as well. We've had, three or four incidents over the last 3 or 4 days.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, every war is multiple wars. And the U.S. Ramping up for war with Russia and China, with Syria and Iran, war, global war, war on many fronts. At the same time, there is a war here at home. And, you know, what many people have forgotten is that the working class is doing worse in terms of income and standards of living than they have in 25 years, and their conditions are in decline. The crisis of the working class, the stepped up exploitation of workers, no matter if you're undergreed or if you have a PhD, if you're a GED, all workers are under attack. The trade union movement is a shell. Mainly of bureaucrats and aristocrats who speak for themselves and not for the conditions of the working people. This continued armed and terroristic assault upon the black community. So we have wars within wars, a internal war that parallels the international crises that are both wars and preparations for war. So, you know, some people are going to have to begin to think in more complex and holistic terms about what we're dealing with. And this piecemealing it, let's just get past the election. Let's just keep Trump out of there. And then we'll decide what to do. I don't think we have that kind of time. We have to decide what the situation is right now, what the people are prepared to do in fighting for their rights. And then a general strategy with tactics has to be developed to meet the demands politically of the working class and people generally at this time.
You know, on the point, let's look at labor, for example, and you know, in the working class. We've had a working class uprising in the Democratic Party. People can characterize it however they like. That's what it was. That's what it is. With the people that were behind Sanders, and a working class uprising and takeover of the Republican Party that now is being challenged by the establishment media. Well, are they really workers? Is it just workers without a college education? Is it blah, 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 all of that? You've got the uprising in the streets that's taken place from the working class. Yeah. And so you had the theft of the election in the Democratic Party, basically, by the establishment. You've had the defection of all of the high-level Republicans and the Republican donors from the Republican Party lining up behind Clinton. And you've had what is an apparent step-up in the assault on the black community by the establishment, and, you know, coming in the form of bullets. And a plea, nevertheless, to line up behind the very forces that are conducting this war against the working class.
Right, right. You know, that is get in the big tent or get in the clown car.
Right.
I think that's the worst of all possible scenarios for the left. And it's a tragedy. It's a tragedy. And so much of what we call the left are intellectuals who operate in isolation and talk to only a few people and then come out with their grand pontifications. This is, when you try to find historical comparisons, go back to 1913, 1914, you know, a little over 100 years ago. Yeah, maybe that kind of fits this moment. But then you say not completely. A lot of people say, well, you have to look at Germany in the 1930s and 1920s. Yes, maybe, but I think when they look at Germany, as we've discussed before, in the 20s and 30s, they miss the point that maybe we are where Germany was in the late 1930s right now, irrespective of the election. But we are in new political territory. We are, as humanity, a place where we have never been. And the crises are enormous because the weapons of war are so much more destructive than they've ever been. And we have people at the helm of the military and of the government who seem to have lost their minds, who think you can wage nuclear war and keep your nation safe or your class safe, that nuclear war will not mean species annihilation. But this is what we're dealing with. And that is why, you know, Don, you and I, we went to the Republican Party convention. We went to the Democratic Party convention. We wanted to know who these people were, who these insurgents were and what they were capable of. And if within them, not within Trump or Clinton or Sanders, but within the people, there was the potential to see through the fog of confusion and war and propaganda, to see their interests, their class interests and the interests of humanity in the fight for peace, in the fight against these trade deals, and so on and so forth. And what we saw is, you know, we saw something of that, but we saw it only in its beginnings. And I guess there's going to be, you know, some serious, serious problems for the people, some great tragedy for nations like Syria already in the throes of a great tragedy, but this could metastasize throughout the world. And perhaps it will take that to finally bring our people to a sense of what the situation is and what the dangers are.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.